couplings will all meet at some point. So where do they meet? And the cow couplings, you know, for SO10, there's predictions of the masses are related to one another because the cow couplings are all tied to each other under SO10. And so, and that actually doesn't like to work. So then it's a question of you play with the model a little bit to make it running stronger than you that would have naively been. So there'll be a suite of predictions like the proton decay rate. See, for the couplings unifying, that tells you the scale of this page group breaking, and that tells you the scale of proton decay. And so then that gives you, if you knew what that scale was, you'd know exactly the proton lifetime has to be. So if you don't see the proton decay, then you know what it has to decay into. It's not going to just decay, it'll decay in, say, positron, neutral pion, or with specific branching ratios. So those are the things you look for. So supersymmetric models typically prefer to make the decay involve more than one iteration. So rather than the proton decay into, say, an electron, a positron, a neutral pion, it would prefer to go to a muon. So by comparing the branching ratios into different things, once you see the decay, then of course you see a lot of things. You'll see the decay in the more than one final state probably, and so you know the ratio of the branching, you know, the rates of those final states.
Right.
So those, you know, once you especially see evidence for grouping, you depend on a lot of things that you get to correlate.
How would you see proton decay though? You will still have to wait like h to the universe between two decays, so it's not like you can test the branching ratios very much.
That's why they made these big, that's where they made the trigger detectors were initially made to look for proton decay. So any one decay is rare, but you have a shitload of things decaying, and then you can make it to the house. It's still rare, but it's not once in a million, like one year or so. Because the age of the universe, you know, so it's 10 to the a year is 10 to the 7 seconds, and so if you go 10 to the 10 years, that's 10 to the 17 seconds. So if you have 10 to the 23 protons, then that becomes something which is not so rare. The trick is to see it, though, because you have to pick it out of the background. But that's why they have these big tanks in it.
Thanks.
One of you guys asked about to tell you what I'm working from. I'm working from the last few chapters of the book, the Scatterplot book. That's where most of the stuff is, but not in this detail. What's on sale now? Operators are standing by. Great stocking stuffer. This is.
Oh, I haven't really had one.
Only one?
Will it come wrapped in a chamois?
Yeah, that's the guy I need.
There you go.
That's the metric style I'm looking for.
You need a microphone, you know?
Yeah. Every 5 minutes, don't say we can't do this all day.
Yeah.
That guy died,
is he?
No, that's for underage sex.
I thought it was for beating a prostitute.
Oh, imagine that. Too.
Oh, okay. Is that Vince guy?
I thought he died.
It's the guy with the other guy. Yeah, there's two big infomercial guys.
What's the other guy?
Billy Mays?
Billy Mays.
What's he
sell?
Everything else?
He's the Bowflex guy.
Forget it.
Exactly. I hate my fat clothes, my fat friends.
You're talking about the skinny guy? It's like,
that's the Shamwell guy.
Skinny guy. Yeah. He got arrested?
Yeah.
That's
not
the
worst. It's calling the Shamwell. Slap child. You'll be slapping your troubles away. Did you see when Rick Mercer
did a spoof on the commercials? Yeah.
All right, what are the three categories? So the one that's probably the most popular is one where you say, well, suppose there's a symmetry which makes these particles have to come in a correlated way. So every time there's a particle, there's another particle nearby. And if these guys were to be canceling in their contributions to these Cs, where the cancellation would be perfect if it had the same mass and same coupling, but it's not perfect because the mass is not exactly the same. as long as these they're split by the center of this mountain down here, so this splitting is of the order of the big scale. Any of you business. And you want a symmetry to enforce these guys to be close to each other, because you want the argument to be like this argument here, where the electron mass was protected because there was a symmetry that protected it. You knew that the correction to the electron mass was proportional to the electron mass, because when the electron mass vanished, the correction had to vanish. And it had to vanish because in the limit that it vanished, there was a symmetry which forbade the corrections from... You know, the corrections didn't break the symmetry. So that's the kind of argument you'd like to have. So you look for a symmetry... forces new particles to arise in multiples. The can cancel C2. And the problem is there's not a lot of symmetries that do that, because any symmetry like that would be one. If the limit of the symmetry was exact, it would be one that would forbid you from correcting at all in C2. But phi dagger phi is invariant under any internal symmetry where you rotate these guys by things that are invariant, leave the kinetic symmetry correct. So some unitary transformation amongst or some orthogonal transformation amongst all the components. So the symmetry you're looking for can't be an internal symmetry. So it has to be a space-time symmetry, in the sense that something for which the Lagrangian is not invariant, but the action is, so that something that varies in the fourth derivative. But there's not a lot of space-time symmetry, so it's not Lagrangian invariance, because that's already true in the standard model of invariant. And so the big surprise was there was quantum supersymmetry that does this. And the only known example here is, actually the other known example would be scale invariance. Scale invariance is a space-time symmetry which will destroy anything which has any dimensional coefficient. But scale invariance, we know, I'll come back to that. Ask me that. I don't know if I'll say something about it. There's a... There's a story there. So, supersymmetry... So I'll write here in scale invariance. Are the only known symmetries that can forbid scalar mass. And the problem, part of the problem with scalar invariance is that we don't want the mass to be zero, we want it to be not corrected from the value it has at standard model. So the scale invariance one doesn't work in detail. That doesn't mean it can't be made to work in detail, and that more power to try to do that. But it doesn't work in detail, where supersymmetry does. What happens with supersymmetry is that every particle is related by the supersymmetry to a particle whose spin differs by 1/2 a unit. So every spin zero particle gets related to a spin 1/2 particle. Every spin 1/2 particle is either related to a spin zero particle or to a spin 1 particle. And spin 1 gets related to spin 1/2, or spin 3/2, and spin 3/2 gets related to spin 1 or spin 2. Spin 2 gets related to spin 3/2, and then if there's nothing more than spin 2, then that's all you do. And so the reason that's a good thing is that you're relating scalar mass with fermion mass, and you can forbid fermion mass with symmetry, like chiral symmetries that keep the electron mass, like they can keep the electron mass, any fermion mass would be protected by a symmetry. So that if I have another symmetry which relates the scalar to a fermion whose mass is protected, then we're in business. So the idea is rate gainer fermion whose mass you can protect. And so in detail, what happens in this kind of matching calculation is that the bosons and the fermions tend to come in with opposite signs. So in a supersymmetric theory, you find that C2 hat would be equal to C2, say half hat would be equal to C2 hat, plus some coupling constant involving the bosons times the boson mass square minus, say, the coupling constant involving the fermions times the fermion mass square. So if the fermion mass difference and the couplings are not so different, then this thing will be of the order of some coupling over 16 pi squared times the splitting in the masses squared, supersymmetric splitting. So as long as the supersymmetry breaking scale is at the weak scale, then you'd have an understanding as to why, as you come through the threshold, you're always getting corrections that are not bigger than what you want, than what you see at low energies, because there's a systematic cancellation going on that's being driven by the symmetry that ties the fermions to bosons in their contributions. But that only works if the supersymmetry is broken at the low energy. If you break supersymmetry to high scales, then these cancellations are failing at this level, and then the problem is back. So it's only supersymmetry broken at low energies. That's option one. Option two would be, well, an assumption everywhere, but in these effective theories all the way up, you have an operator whose coefficient was C2. So option two would be, what if there's no Higgs in these theories up here? So suppose
no Higgs field. The effective field theory. Much above the weak scale.
In that case, there's no H dagger H term in your Lagrangian, whose coefficient you get to worry about. Now you have to worry about other terms, but if you can avoid having scalars at all, then you. The dangerous terms were the ones involving the scalars. With fermions, the only thing you could write down that was less than dimension 4 was something at dimension 3, which is the mass term. And there were symmetries that could forbid that. The standard model gauge group forbade all the direct explicit masses of the fermions weren't allowed until you coupled to the Higgs boson. So it's easy to get rid of the fermion low dimension operators. But the scalars are the dangerous ones. It's been one part of building our problem because gauge invariance tends to organize them into covariant derivatives or gauge field strength, so the scalars are problems. If you have no scalars, then you're generically not going to expect to have these low dimension things to worry about. Also tend to require some other range of scalars. So how can you avoid having a Higgs field in your high energy theory? Well, it's like if you imagine thinking about the very low energies below the QCD scale, this effective theory had protons in it and neutrons and pions, and those things are not in the high energy theory because those things we know are built by quarks and gluons. The thing that's in this theory is the quarks and gluons. So one way to have the Higgs not survive to high energies is that it might be composite. It might be made of something more fundamental. This is probably the historically conservative option in the sense that if you think of what happened in the past, that's the kind of thing that happened in the past, is that the things that were elementary turned out to not be elementary because they're made of something else. So this has the history on its side. The difficulty is that it's fairly difficult to make one because you're talking about bound states. Unless you actually know the physics of the binding, which in this case you do because it's QCD. They didn't when they found out quarks there, but that's what made it hard to discover the quarks. So if you don't understand the physics of the binding, it's hard to make detailed statements about what the properties of bound states are. So it's hard to test the theories. So
they're typically strongly coupled.
Because of the mousey. And so it's more difficult to test them. The original proposal was called Technicolor. And the idea there was that supposing you had a gauge group at very high energies that the Grand Unified Scale, which was, say, SU4, cross SU3, cross SU2, cross U1. And when the couplings run, the non-abelian couplings are all getting stronger at low energies. But the bigger the group, the faster they climb. So if you look at the couplings, not one of the couplings now, it's a bunch of energy. And the SU2 will do this, SU3 will do this, SU4 will do this. And if they all start at the same place, like in some Grand Unified theory, then you can expect that SU4 will get strong first, and then that there'll be some composite things built to that. Maybe that's what's making the Higgs. And then it would explain, because this learning is logarithmic, it would explain, and that the unification has to happen at high energies, this kind of picture would explain why these things are low energies in the first place, because it's this logarithm running from a weak coupling to high energies. It would explain why this unknown group became strong first, because it's running faster. And if you can make that into some sort of a theory of the balance state, so it's very much like color, because it just happens at a higher scale. That's kind of the motivation of Technicolor, was it tried to make it QCD-like, because people understand a lot about how QCD behaves. And if you didn't have this thing, if you didn't have a Higgs boson and you just had the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, then eventually the SU3 would provide a Higgs boson for you. If you didn't have the Higgs boson that the standard model has, once the QCD scale gets hit, and you start making pions and things, the pions would become the Higgs bosons. And so the observation was that if you didn't have the Higgs, the QCD would give you one. But the scale of the Higgs in that case would just be the QCD scale, because that's where the Higgs mass would be. And so they tried to copy that to make it happen with a group that was going to get strong at the higher scale. So it was a nice idea. But the original idea is get hung up on getting the details right, because the Higgs is giving you masses, and so you have to know how this composite is coupled to the ordinary fermions, and you have to have the right masses and the right mixing angles on the one hand, but not have dangerous flavor-changing nuclear currents on the other hand. And it's difficult to walk that line. But not impossible, and there are models now, actually there's probably more models in this class than there were before, and ironically they are usually built in extra dimensions. It used to be thought that you had a choice between extra dimensions and Technicolor, but it's turning out that the best way to think about Technicolor is in extra dimensions, because there's a duality that relates them to each other. And it's strongly coupled here, but its extra dimensional analog is with the coupled, and you can calculate the simple thing. So this is kind of the second class that's very plausible. Could be there.
So I work for those strongly coupled theories in Cooper pairing, that's not strongly coupled, and that also provides a composite, right? So
actually, that is strong.
But the gap is really small. Cooper pairing, isn't it?
Yeah, but this gap is going to be very small compared to that scale.
Oh, I see.
It's very similar in the sense that if you do this, that's actually one of the later topics. Is that if you're up at the bi frequency in the solid, that's where the phonon energies are very strong, phonons are very weak.
Yeah.
But if you look at the interactions amongst fermions that are near a Fermi surface. And almost all interactions are irrelevant as you come down. And the analog of this is that almost all interactions die off as you get to lower energies. Because the kinematics is a little different because you've got a Fermi surface there. And the Fermi surface is blocking interactions that would have otherwise been important. And so that's kind of why the free electron metal model of the metal works, is that it doesn't really depend on the details. You're not actually changing literally the free theory. But if you had interactions that were originally weak, they would tend to become weaker and weaker and weaker as you went to lower energies. And so what's suppressing the interactions is the energy of your conductivity measurements compared to these fundamental scales. But there's one exception to that statement, and that is that if you have a Fermi surface and you pair things in opposite directions, those states that are on opposite sides of the Fermi surface, operators that connect those things, they are exactly marginal. So they are at the classical level, they're marginal, so their strength doesn't change. So this is one thing that doesn't get weaker, but then to know what happens to them, you have to kind of work to next order perturbation theory for that. And if the relevant interaction is repulsive, then it turns out that it's also irrelevant in the sense that it gets smaller. It's only logarithm getting smaller. But if it's attractive, it actually grows. And so what happens is it's very much like this, there's a lot of rhythmic running, which eventually gets strong. And then at that point, that's where you get a balance error. And that's why the superconducting scales are very small compared to typical scales of solids, is that there was some longer running that took place before they got strong. So it's very much like this picture. I think this was inspired by this. And so it's that kind of picture of getting a hierarchy from a log is due to the learning of arguing in other directions pretty powerful. I hope to do this as an example in the take of time. The effect of field theories at the Fermi surface. But if I don't get to that, there's a really nice article by Polchinski. It's at the Tassie Summer School in the early 90s called The Effect of Field Theory at the Fermi Surface. And it kind of takes us, he describes that for particle physics. So it's really, really great. All right, that's two options. And then the third option is the option where you say, you've done the option where the Higgs is actually in the high energy theory, but there's a symmetry which keeps the contributions as you go through thresholds from being large. There's the option where you don't have the Higgs in the high energy theory, and so that's why you don't have to worry about the C2s, because there's no C2 to think about. And you might have thought that was the only two options, and that's what people did for a long time. But there is a third option. The third option is to deny there's anything at higher scales than the Higgs scale. So it's kind of the radical break. So the third option is always denial. So there is no scale. Larger. And well, the immediate reply to that is, well, we know the Planck scale is bigger than weight. And the thing is that's M Planck isn't a mass. When I mean scale here, I mean there's no physical threshold. Because we're interested in going through these thresholds. And you'll see that there's a sense in which this is really like this. But I'm going to start off this way. So what about the Planck mass? Well, before answering that, M Planck was really related to M Planck squared is related to 8 pi Newton's constant to the minus 1. So it's not really a mass of a particle, it's a coupling constant. And so we have examples like that already in other places, physical leading directions. So this is like looking at the Fermi constant, the minus 1. That turns out to be 10 to the 5 GeV squared. Something like 246 GeV squared. Which factors that root 2 is. But if you imagine asking, so this is a scale that's coming from a coupling constant. In this case, we know what the particle was that was whose exchange was responsible for this force. If that kind of the weak force comes when you exchange a W boson or a Z boson. And so there's a coupling at both ends. And what the weak interaction is at low energies, this propagator is approximately equal to 1 over the weak mass squared. And so what the weak G Fermi, for conventional reasons, G Fermi over 2 is, it's really G squared over M weak squared is a factor of 8, or what here is, for historical reasons. So if you were to ask, is the value you get from G Fermi a good tracker for what W mass is, and you'd say that, well, it's not so bad, but it's not exactly right. The W mass that's really being exchanged there is more like 80 GeV. And the difference is these factors of 8 and root 2 and the dimensional coupling. So they differ. As a dimensionless coupling. So what about M Planck? Could it be possibly true that the scale associated with M Planck is actually much different than the measured value of M Planck? This is the thing that's MV18 Sometimes when people say that they're implanting a 10 to the 19 GB, they're not putting a safe pi in. That's the minimum difference. All right. So what about that? So now the observation that was that makes this option viable is that if you have extra dimensions, so you can imagine that at every point in space, there's some extra dimension which stays a circle. And then you can identify that with that. That would be an example of an extra dimension. There could be more than one of these dimensions. But if you ask, what's the strength of gravity in the four dimensions that we see compared to the extra dimensions, there's an interesting thing that happens. That if I drew this another way of drawing, that would be that this is the extra dimension, and this is the dimension, one of the dimensions you do see. You have a mass here, and you look at the force line of the gravity spreading out. They spread out according to the Newton's law, appropriate to their dimension. And Newton's law says I take the flux lines have to go somewhere, so if I take the surface, if surrounded by a Gaussian pillbox that has a certain surface area, then the flux is a constant. So since the area goes like r squared in four dimensions, the force has to go like 1 over r squared. But if you did it in d dimensions, d space dimensions, the area would go like d minus 1, r to d minus 1, so the force would go like 1 over r to d minus 1. So if this is going like force goes like 1 over r to d minus 1, eventually the force lines hit the edge of the dimensions, and so they, you know, they have to start spreading out. So if you only measure your Gaussian pillbox out distances like this, then what happens is that dimensions that were internal have stopped growing at the size of the extra dimensions, called a. So this would become 1 over r squared times a to the b minus 3, I guess. And so the coefficient here would be Newton's constant in the extra dimensions. And so now we'll have Newton's. So then this whole thing would be what we call Newton's constant in four dimensions, and one dimension. So that shows you that Newton's constant is really the Newton's constant in the extra dimensions times basically the volume of the extra dimensions. So the idea is that if the extra dimensions are very, very large, there can be a very, very big difference between Newton's constant that we measure in gravitational experiments from the fundamental scale to the Lagrangian right now. And this dimensionless factor can be enormous. So in terms of M Planck, if I say that G star is 1 over M star in the appropriate dimension, so that would be D minus 2. D minus 1 times space dimensions. Then M Planck squared is M star D minus 1. Times A D minus 3. So dimensions squared. Well, let's square root that. No, let's square root. Plus 2. So minus 1, minus 2. Is that right? That works. That's the dimensional grounds that works. So if I look at the ratio of Planck over M star squared, that's given by M star times A D minus 3. And so this, in order to calculate anything, this size has to be large compared to the Planck scale and the dimensions. And that could be very large. So this dimensionless factor between the fundamental scale and the Planck scale can be much, much, much smaller than this factor was here. And so it's not crazy to think about the fundamental scale of gravity being much, much lower than the Planck scale. And as far as we know, the lowest it could be, M star could be as low as the TED scale. So, you know.
Is that the scale of low expression?
Right? These numbers space dimensions, yeah. Because I've been counting things as if they were D minus 1 was two and three edges. No, so I'm not including time. All right. So there's a whole story here, which I could beat you over the head with, but it's this is kind of the third way out. And it leads to the first way out because you have to then address what happens when you get to the scales. This would be saying that the scale of gravity actually is at the weak scale. And but then at the weak scale, if you want to ask this question of what's going on above the weak scale, then you have to have a theory of quantum gravity. And so there's not a lot of those in which you can actually, that are to the point where you can actually pose the question in a focused way. But an example of string theory, and string theory, you could then ask the question in string theory, you have all sorts of string states here. And what happens, do they screw up do they cause a problem with your Higgs mechanism? And then it depends a little bit as to whether or not how you see this error model arise in your theory of quantum gravity. It could arise in a supersymmetric way, in which case this starts to meld into option one. Or it could do it through this other way. It could be that the standard model, string theory gives you the standard model of the Higgs, and there's a composite mechanism for that. So this option three really just says that the thing that happens at the weak scale could be much weirder than you think. In the sense that you might not be in a space-time picture, it could be a really, really bizarre theory about the weak scale, because the scale of gravity could be right there. And that's something which is a little, you might quibble a little bit about being a third option. It really changes the way you think about what the options are about the weak scale and the fourth plane, and so it's really
exciting. You feel Q's theory. You feel the string's theory.
No.
You feel the Q's theory. Then Sushi must be broken, at least at the old Higgs scale. It could be broken at a high line scale.
Are they showing? There are not Sushi.
What is coming in which?
You're asking, are there non supersymmetric strings? And there are. The question. So as I'm saying, I don't really know in the sense that there are non-supersymmetric strings that don't have tachyons, but it may be true that you can think of them as being supersymmetric strings with supersymmetric breaking at the string scale. I'm not really sure. They have kind of a funny thing. Is that not true?
No, there are non-Suzy. I mean, well, it depends on how seriously you want to take it, but there are string models that lack target-based supersymmetry.
Yeah, but
don't have tachyons at one loop level.
That would agree with. But then the question is, could I think of them efficiently as being deformations of supersymmetric ones where I've broken the supersymmetry at the string scale? Because I know that in Keith's stuff, there's correlations between the cancellations that are going in and the cosmological consequences that are happening in string, across string levels.
Right, they're happening across string levels, so I know.
So I think what Hanmin's looking for is a case where there's no sense in which supersymmetry is a symmetry at the string scale, but it's much, much higher. And I don't know if that makes sense.
Supposedly it's broken at string scale, and Suji may be broken in Bay Tower cancellation for the X-Cast.
Sure. I would say that it's not known that it has to be symmetric at the string scale. I think there are examples at the string scale that are not symmetric.
The models with larger fundamentals should be based on the assumption that changes must be broken. If they want to think that it's not made.
Well, given there exist string models that are not supersymmetric, why is that true?
Yeah.
Then if you have a unit composition of non supersymmetric string, then this may not be a function.
We'd have to check though, right? No one knows it's not a
It's not open. Yeah. It's just a solution.
Yeah, nothing's apparent straightforward. I would say that it's just unknown, and so you have to look. People know a lot more about the supersymmetric solution because those are the ones that are easier to control. But that doesn't mean that the properties that you can ascribe, but everything that's true for supersymmetric is not true for the non-supersymmetric. You have to look at them. And I don't think a lot of people have. So let me close off here somewhere. There was one last thing I wanted to say. Part of the next thing to say is maybe there's an afternoon. So please agree. Just see you back here at 2:30. Thank you.